The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, this is somewhat of an experiment today. The North Carolina Reading Services are closed, like so many other businesses and organizations, and I'm recording this in a home studio and trying to coordinate the background intro and outro music and see how it goes, and hopefully I will end on time and not run over or cut you short. I'd like to read a couple of articles today to you. You know, we've been reading these series, the 1940s, 1950s, and now the 1960s, the dynamic decade. And we are in the 60s section here in 2020. The name of the article today is The Full Court Press. In 1969, North Carolina bounds into the national court. Fans across the Piedmont rallied to support the state's first pro basketball team. Do you remember the name? I wasn't here then. The Carolina Cougars. And this is written, as it always is, by Philip Gerard. There's a two-page spread of basketball players doing their thing on the court in this black-and-white photo, which is no pun on the fact that there are black-and-white players on the court. And the caption says, in March 1971, the Carolina Cougars lost to the Memphis Pros at Dorton Arena. During a rematch a year later, Larry Miller, showed in this picture, scored 67 points, a league record. After National Geographic puts North Carolina on the map as the Dixie Dynamo, a place of national interest, the state finds itself playing in a higher league. Figuratively in business, education, and technology, and in the sporting scene, literally. In 1960, Kinston has a population of about 25,000, considered by many to be too small a market to support a professional basketball team. The Eagles, a Washington Senators farm team, left in 1957 after only a few weeks. But in 1962, Kinston attracts a stronger team affiliated with the Pittsburgh Pirates to join a league that includes rosters in Burlington, Durham, and Greensboro. The new Kinston Eagles. In their first season, the Eagles take the Carolina League Championship. As Kinston shows it can support a minor league enterprise, many sports fans dream of a major league franchise, not necessarily in baseball. The state has long gloried in its college basketball tradition. Teams at UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, Davidson, Wake Forest, NC State, and others have won legions of loyal, even rabid fans. But it has never been home to a professional basketball team. National Basketball Association, NBA franchises, have mostly been reserved for large metro areas with fan bases that can fill giant arenas, such as New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And since the 1953-54 season, many of their games have been nationally televised, a generous source of income that helps insure against losses from uneven attendance. In 1960, the NBA fields just 8 teams. Officially founded in 1949, the NBA evolved from the Basketball Association of America, the BAA, where a blade-thin, 6'6", 185-pound shooter got his professional start. Horace Bones McKinney was already a legend in his own right, as much for his clownish antics on the court as for his accurate shooting. Whenever a ref called a foul on him, McKinney would wait until the ref's back was turned, then drop to his knees in feigned supplication. McKinney starred on the Durham High School team that captured 3 state championships and won 69 consecutive games. In a closed-door scrimmage, they claimed a 15-point victory over the varsity squad of Duke University. During the 1942 season at NC State, McKinney led not only his team, but the entire Southern Conference in scoring. He did a 2-year and 9-month stint in the Army as a draftee, then played for UNC Chapel Hill in 1946. But money was always a struggle, and now married to his lifelong love, Edna, he dropped out to earn a living at the Haynes Hosiery Plant. He writes, "The only way I could ever play basketball again was for somebody to pay me a salary to put me in a uniform." And since in 1946 there was no such thing as professional basketball, there was no chance of that. But he was wrong. Red Auerbach, head coach of the Washington Capitals, who would forge his own legend with the Boston Celtics starting in 1950, signed McKinney for $6,750 per season, with $500 up front. McKinney went on to coach as well as play for the Caps, recruiting their first black player, Earl Lloyd, and finishing his pro playing career in Boston, reuniting with Auerbach. But Bones wasn't finished with basketball. He served as assistant coach at Wake Forest for 5 years, earning $50 a week, even as he pursued theological studies to become an ordained minister and preached Sunday sermons at far-flung Baptist churches. "You might think that coaching and preaching don't mix," he writes sardonically. "But all coaches have to do a little preaching to their players from time to time, and most preachers have to coach the members of their congregation, especially before the collection." As Wake Forest head coach between 1957 and 1965, he compiles a record of 122-94, including 2 conference championship seasons. He's a theatrical figure on the court, dressed in signature red socks, a new twist on his superstitious habits with the Caps. Dressing one night for an away game, he realizes that he has forgotten to pack socks. The only pair he can borrow is bright red. "We won that night, so I wore them the next night and the next night, and they became a tradition," he writes. "The one game where he forgets to wear them, the team loses, and that's the last time he forgets." He guzzles 25 Pepsi Colas per day and chain smokes cigarettes. Courtside, he's always in motion. He's said to have once used a seatbelt to restrain himself from his tendency to walk onto the court. Inevitably, legends grow up around him. So in 1967, when a rival league forms to challenge the monopoly of the NBA, and one of its franchises winds up in North Carolina, it seems fitting that McKinney finds himself in the middle of it. He leaves Wake Forest after a disappointing season. The American Basketball Association, ABA, brings with it an opportunity for new markets in places like Denver, Indiana, New Orleans, and Dallas. The league encourages a wide-open running playground style of play, using red, white, and blue balls, extends the shot clock from 24 to 30 seconds, and adds a 3-point field goal. Its games are as much about showmanship as they are about athletic prowess. McKinney fits right in. One of the new teams, the Houston Mavericks, struggles on and off the court. Jim Gardner, a North Carolina congressman who, legend has it, won his controlling interest in the Hardee's hamburger chain in a poker game, heads a group of investors called the Southern Sports Corporation. Gardner's consortium buys the Houston franchise for $350,000 and moves it to Greensboro in 1969. The new freewheeling league, Gardner's Consortium, takes a novel approach. The team will operate as a regional franchise to maximize its fan base. The newly renamed Cougars will play their home games in Greensboro, Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Raleigh. If one city isn't big enough to support a pro team, they are betting that four cities can together. Gardner hires McKinney on a 3-year contract for $35,000 per year. McKinney is delighted to find himself coaching younger players from his old conference. Bob Verga, who played for Duke from 1964 to 67 and holds the single season scoring record with an average of 26.1 points per game. Doug Moe, a 6'5" forward who averaged 20.4 points and 14 rebounds per game with UNC in 1960-61 before being unjustly suspended in a betting scandal. Another UNC alum, Larry Miller, All-American and 2-time ACC Player of the Year in 1966-67 and in 67-68, and George Lehman, who played under McKinney during his freshman year at Wake Forest. Of the 12-man Cougars game roster, 4 are African-Americans. The Carolina Cougars are pioneers. No other team has ever tried the regional franchise approach. Frank DeFord, a writer for Sports Illustrated, claims credit for the idea. Sports, such as baseball and basketball, have long seasons with lots of games, and the big city markets are already taken, he writes in the October 21, 1968 edition of Sports Illustrated. A regional team could work especially well in North Carolina, a great basketball area of medium-sized cities with good arenas. When he revisits the idea on January 19, 1970, he jokes that his baby has been taken in by some people who were much more capable of providing for him than I was. They have nourished him and educated him and given him a name, Carolina Cougars, or Ka'alana Cougars, as the team is known in the lovable vernacular. The team's example, DeFord predicts, is bound to cause repercussions throughout the whole of professional sport. The Cougars have proven that a regional franchise is not only interesting, but downright practical. The new league, however, lacks a TV contract that will generate a reliable big income stream. Its teams play in smaller arenas, sometimes to sparse crowds. Many in the sports world disparage the ABA. Auerbach, by now firmly established with the formidable Boston Celtics, says, "We thought it was a bunch of guys trying to become pests. I felt, let 'em rot." But the Carolina Cougars present a fast-moving, colorful style of play and gain strong followings in Greensboro and Charlotte. Raleigh fans seem less enthusiastic, judging by the crowd size at home games there. Bones McKinney is just as colorful. He coaches the Cougars in between directing the rehabilitation program of the state prison system, working the broadcast booth at ACC games, and preaching as a Baptist minister. He is never still, directs critical monologues at the refs, and remains as much a star as any player. At one game, protesting a call, he supposedly tells the ref, "You are either a thief or incompetent." The ref ejects him from the game. McKinney asks him why. The ref replies, "Because you called me a thief." "Oh, my goodness. No, indeed," McKinney tells him. "I gave you a choice." The ABA lasts just 9 full seasons before being absorbed into the NBA, and by then the Cougars are gone from the scene. But the dream of pro basketball franchise in North Carolina is a stubborn one. Big league ambition outstripping economic reality for a little while longer. We have a sidebar. It says Hall of Hoops, Bones McKinney is in esteemed company in the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame Museum. The banner for the late coach, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1970, hangs from the rafters in the basketball section of the museum, along with pennants for the state's greatest players and coaches. Among hoops memorabilia, including uniforms and trophies, as well as a video exhibit celebrating iconic moments in college basketball history, the banners pay fitting tribute to those who helped forge the inseparable bond between basketball and North Carolina. So says Tom Delaney. The North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame is at 3 East Edenton Street on the third floor in Raleigh. They have a website, nchof.org. And that was from our 60s Decade series by Philip Gerard. And he tells us that coming in April, students at a vigil sit in after the death of Martin Luther King. You are listening to our state magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on the program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. I don't think there'll be anybody there, but somebody is checking messages, and they will get back to me. So, I hope to hear from you, if you have something that you'd like to say. Now we turn on to our next article under the moniker Middle Mountains, the Gold Rush. The name of the article is Misfortune in the Mine. A quarter century before 300,000 gold prospectors headed west in search of their fortunes, a repository near Morro Mountain produced some of America's purest ore. Beset by bad luck, the Barrington Mine tells the story of North Carolina's gold rush and the ways it changed the land. John Fisher listened to the scrape and rattle of shovels as several workers cleared a path through the long-ago cave-in inside a horizontal shaft of the Barrington Gold Mine in Misenheimer. Fisher and the workers were about 200 feet beneath the surface of the rolling hills of northern Stanley County. Nearly a century has passed since 8 miners died a sudden and horrible death here on a wet August afternoon in 1904, millions of gallons of water had plunged down the mine's vertical entrance shaft and filled up the mine so quickly that only one man escaped. The Barrington Mine had closed a year after the miners' deaths, but in 1998, Fisher, who grew up in Stanley County not far from the mine, was a partner in an effort to resume working the old digs. He was entering the mine to try to determine whether it was worth reopening. The work crew was clearing a path through the shaft, known to miners as an adit, A-D-I-T, so that Fisher could take a look at the last place the miners worked before the tragedy. The crew had cleared away enough dirt for Fisher to get through the opening. The scene was illuminated by bobbing lights on hard hats. It was a different kind of darkness deep underground, as dark can get, Fisher recalls. He passed a round room that had been excavated to expose a vein of rock, and then he entered a cutout and looked around at a tableau that had last been touched 94 years earlier, when Theodore Roosevelt was president. The Wright brothers' famous flight was less than a year in the past, and Misenheimer was known as Gladstone. Fisher saw a workbench carved out of one wall. A couple of shovels and wheelbarrows were scattered around the area, along with what appeared to be dynamite fuses. Small chunks of rock lay on the floor of the adit. The miners had been making holes in the rock with a handheld 20-inch drill and small sledgehammers, pounding the drills into the veins, twisting them, and repeating the process until the holes were deep enough to insert sticks of dynamite. A couple of drills protruded from the wall where the miners had left them when they heard the torrent of water rushing down the mine's entrance shaft. Fisher felt a flush of excitement as he looked around the room, but that was quickly replaced by concern. The adit had caved in once, it could happen again. The euphoria of the moment kept me from feeling fear, he recalls. Then I thought, what the hell am I doing here? I didn't want to alarm anybody, but I realized it was time to quietly exit. Fisher took a few photos and picked up several chunks of the blue-green rock lying on the floor of the attic, and then he and the workers returned to daylight. The Barringer Mine was one of dozens of gold mines that in the 19th and early 20th centuries pockmarked the hills of the counties that branch out from Morrow Mountain at the edge of Uwari National Forest. The possibility, however, a mode of finding gold whenever someone sticks a shovel in the ground, has become ingrained in the local collective consciousness. If you're digging a ditch on someone's land, they'll joke back and forth that if you find gold, they'll split it with you, says Jim Meisenheimer, a retired school administrator and teacher, and the town councilman in nearby Richfield. The gold deposits were created millions of years ago when ancient volcanoes pushed up the surrounding Uwari Mountains. The range once topped 20,000 feet or more, but the passage of time has worn them down so that the tallest peaks are now a little over 1,000 feet. Today, the Uwaris rise above the landscape, not as towering mountains, but as rolling blue hills. Crossroads communities and small towns. Baden, Denton, New London, Mount Gilead, Gold Hill, Meisenheimer, Richfield, Seagrove are scattered throughout. Most of these little towns had a gold mine nearby at some point in the 19th century. The Uwaris became known for their outlandishly large gold nuggets in 1803, when Cabarrus County farmer John Reed sold a 17-pound nugget that his son had found in a creek. A jeweler in Fayetteville paid Reed $3.50 for it, the equivalent of about $80 in today's money. Farmers and newcomers started combing the region's creeks for more gold, and in 1825, Matthias Tobias Barrington, whose farm was about 20 miles northeast of Reed's, began finding nuggets along a section of Long Creek that flowed through his property. Barrington collected gold worth about $8,000, more than $179,000 today, and eventually discovered the first gold vein in quartz in the United States. The find was chronicled in newspapers across the 24 states that then made up the United States. The discovery of Barrington's mine has set the people to searching for gold in places where it was never thought of before. The National Gazette of Philadelphia noted that April. The story depicted the North Carolina Piedmont as an El Dorado, where there was scarcely a mile square in which particles of gold may not be found. After word of his discovery got out, Barrington was beset by a lawsuit challenging the ownership of the land. The suit dragged on for years, and work at his mine was hampered by his legal problems and flooding from Long Creek. Meanwhile, farmers in the surrounding countryside found gold on their lands, and gold seekers from all over the world began arriving. Gold was also discovered in Charlotte, and shafts and adits of mines ran beneath the city streets. So much gold was being found that in 1835, Congress approved the nation's first branch mint in Charlotte to produce gold coins. North Carolina gold became a hot topic nationwide, and high-rolling, well-connected investors, naval officers, members of Congress, even President James Garfield, started sinking their money into the state's mines. By the late 1880s, Barrington had won the legal battle for his property, but he was an old man, and he decided to let it go. The property changed hands several times. In 1888, new owners diverted the flow of Long Creek away from the original entrance shaft. That made work in the mine easier, but it set the stage for tragedy. In 1903, the Barrington Mine was bought by the Whitney Company, which had been set up 4 years earlier to build a dam for a power company at nearby Yadkin River Narrows. Its general manager was an English-born mining engineer named Egbert Barry Cornwall Hembley. North Carolina newspapers buzzed about the Narrows project, one suggesting that it would make the Yadkin the Niagara of the Cotton Belt, transforming the sleepy surrounding towns into bustling industrial cities. By 1901, Hambly and the Whitney Company had bought roughly 15,000 acres in the Moro Mountain area, stretching about 13 miles from each bank of the Yadkin. Less than a year after the company acquired the Barrington Mine, workers at the site uncovered a fortune. 6 tons of ore with an average value of $20,000 per ton, more than $640,000 today. And that was hauled out in just a few days. The Salisbury Sun, or rather Daily Sun, reported masses of almost pure gold as large as a man's fist. The vein showed no signs of giving out. The Whitney Company continued to rake North Carolina gold into its vaults in 1904 while assembling men, machines, and materials for its massive construction project at the Narrows. It seemed that the Barrington Mine, or rather Barringer Mine, was finally producing the wealth that miners had long suspected to exist beneath the ground. On August 18, 1904, 9 miners escaped the steamy dog days of summer when they climbed down the long ladder into the cool shafts of the Barringer Mine. Around 2:30 p.m., the heavens opened. In Charlotte, 1.5 inches of rain fell in only 25 minutes. At the Barrington Mine, flooding broke the earthen dam of a retaining pond that was built after Long Creek had been diverted 16 years earlier. Millions of gallons gushed toward the mine. A giant whirlpool formed at the shaft entrance, and water swirled into the mine like it was draining from a bathtub. Only one miner, an African-American man named Jim Reed, escaped. The others, 7 black and 1 white, died suddenly and terrifying deaths deep into the pitch-black darkness. It took weeks to empty the mine and recover all the bodies. The family of 18-year-old Will Canup, the white miner who'd been killed, sued the Whitney Company. They eventually settled for $1,850, about $54,000 today. No records could be found at the Stanley County Courthouse for the families of the 7 black miners, Henry DeBerry, Charles Udy, Will Harris, John Magnum, James Miller, Caleb Moose, and William Steyerwolf. Later newspaper reports, however, said that all of the families received settlements. Work at the Barringer Mine resumed that fall, but in August 1905, a year after the disaster, the mine shut down for good. The tragedy was a stunning setback for the Whitney Company. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of our State Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.